some of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Rated G Radio. It's the Tuesday show, and we have a spectacular show with an even more spectacular guest, Mr. Ara Gregorian. I love saying his last name. I wanted to say it like five times fast, but I think I might screw it up, so I'm going to just leave it at one. We're going to bring Ara on in just a second. His book that is out right now is called Game of Love, and I thought, okay, we've got a guy writing a romance novel. This is going to be interesting. But I'm telling you, it is a page-turner. I can't put it down. I had to put it down just to do the show tonight, but as soon as the show's over, I'm going back to finish reading the book. So we're going to bring Ara on in just a second. But I want to give you the roadmap, like we always do, about what's been going on the show and what's coming up, so you can go back and listen to all of your favorite episodes. Just a real quick reminder, you can follow the program by clicking the little follow button if you're looking at your computer screen. If you're calling in by the telephone, you'll have no idea what I'm talking about. But go back and check it out on the computer, and you'll see. If you follow it, you can get a text or email every day that we are live. We're live 5 days a week, and it will give you the latest programming updates, because each show has a unique leak. So you can go back and listen to it on demand. So explanation there. Last night we had energy updates and intuitive calls taken by Dr. Annie Ulrich. So we love having Dr. Annie on. She'll be on one more time before the end of the year. I'll encourage you to tune in on December 7th for her next appearance. Tomorrow we have author Walter Newkirk. He's going to be talking about his book having to do with Grey Gardens. We've also got an independent filmmaker, Jill Salvino. She's calling in from New York City. I won't ask her if she makes salsa, but she'll be calling in at 7:45 Pacific time tomorrow night to talk about her new movie, and she'll be sharing all the details about that. Thursday, we have Leon Acord with the web series Old Dogs, New Tricks. It's going into season number four, its fourth and final season, and Leon will be on talking about all the cool things that are happening on a web series that has some longevity. So I'm excited to meet Leon online. He's also starred in the series with Bruce Hart. Bruce has been on the show before. And I don't know if Bruce connected us to Leon or how that came about, but Leon's going to be on the show Thursday. And on Friday, we have Project Grand Slam as our music guest for the show. That's, of course, an hour number one. And an hour number two, it's always listener requests. So get your request lined up early, because usually by the time Friday comes around, we're filled up. We'll play everything that you send in. I'll give you mad shout-outs, and we just have a ton of fun. Now, without further ado, as we like to say every day, it's time to bring our guest, Ara Gregorian. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I just started coughing. I apologize.
I got you all choked up.
You know what? When I do, I'm thinking that radio is probably the best venue for me because you can't see my face. Excuse me. My voice is going.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna put you on hold, and I'm gonna read. Read to the audience, right, chapter 21, that I'll be starting right after the show starts. No. So welcome to the show. And so I always give everybody the 7 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon on how they ended up being here. I was at the Southern California Writers Conference. I think it was last month. I lose track of time. It might have been September. Okay, so now we're 2 months ago, and my dear friends Jeff and Jill, who have been part of the conference for ages, said, "Have you met Ara yet?" And I said, "I don't know if I've met him or not." So they said, "You have to meet him because he's fascinating." And I said, "Well, you would know. Everybody that they've introduced me to has just been great. So we've had, you know, Gail Carline, Dot Caffrey, Kathy Porter, Darlene Quinn. We've got them all that have been on the show, and that they've been introduced through Jeff and Jill. So I'm bowing down to them for the gracious introduction. But I had no idea you were going to be like this incredible, spectacular romance novelist when I met you and I shook your hand. So Jeff and Jill, thank you very much. So Ara, tell me about yourself.
Boy, where do I start? I would say just I'm an average guy, I guess. You know, like most people, especially those who live in Hollywood or thereabouts, whatever you do as a career, you probably have intentions of doing something else too, right? Everybody wants to be an actor, or everybody wants to be a writer. So yeah, for me, you know, I've always been this guy who had dreams, and my dreams were always around telling stories. So for me, my story really is. Here's a guy who came from an immigrant at best, right? Born in Iran, I'm Armenian. I lived in Spain. But by the time I came to the United States, I, you know, English was a really tough, tough language to figure out. So, excuse me, my voice is leaving me. When I came here, I tried to really figure out, you know, how can I be a storyteller? And the reality was that with my language skills, it was not going to happen. So, like any good immigrant, I was either going to be a doctor, or a lawyer, or an engineer. So I decided, you know, engineering is a good one. Why not, right?
Uh-huh.
So, and that's what I did. That was my background. I got my engineering degree from Cal State Northridge. Years later, I got my MBA from USC. Fight on. That was supposed to be my career path, and it really is still my career path. I still love what I do. But I think for those of us who are inclined by the arts or the creative side of the world, it's really hard to just pretend it's not there. It's a calling. It's born in you, and you got to do what you're called to do. And I had to do it. And 5 years, 5 years ago, my wife said, stop dreaming, start doing.
And so can I back up for when you were like a little kid? So when you were growing up, did you write short stories or tell stories or put on plays for your family? How did you know that this was going to be something that was really going to, you know, burn in your loins to write later on in your life?
Yeah, it's funny. I never thought I would be when I was younger, I didn't think I would be a writer. But I did believe all along that I would be able to, I wanted to be a storyteller. My older brother and I, what we would do is we would draw comic books. We were very much into comic books, loved those stories. We would read those time and the imagination would take over. So we would draw. I was a pretty decent artist, but never did anything with it. Back in those days, you know, parents didn't think about, oh, you know how to hold a bat? Let's put you in Little League. Back then, you know, I get an award for art and my parents say, good job. So it was one of those things that I wanted to tell stories through pictures and imagery. But I didn't really know how to write, to be perfectly candid. But my grandfather, he was a writer. He was an actor. He was a Shakespearean playwright. He was a phenomenal man. So I would watch him in awe that what he would do is sit behind this typewriter and, you know, march away on that thing. And then a few months later, he would have a finished book, and then he would have a book signing, and then people would show up and, you know, just wanting to know more about him and read his books. So to me, it was fascinating that he could tell stories through the written word. It didn't have to be through art. It didn't have to be through performance, that there was another way to get there. So that's what really drove me to think that maybe one day I could be a writer.
I love that. Now, what kind of books did your grandfather write?
So first of all, you won't find his stuff on Amazon. He wrote in Armenian, but he wrote he wrote about the 1915 Armenian genocide. He wrote about his story and what happened to his family. After the genocide, he was 14 when he picked up a rifle to defend his home country. But after the war, he went to Vienna and he went to one of the finest schools of theater. And he studied with some of the best, some of the great names out there. And he took it upon himself to translate Shakespeare's plays to Armenian. Phenomenal, phenomenal man. I mean, just a giant. Then he put together a company, and they went around the world from Argentina, Brazil, Portugal, you name it. He traveled the world, and that's what he did. But when he got to a point where he no longer was going to act, he decided that he was going to write about his stories. And he was a phenomenal poet as well. He wrote for the newspaper. It was just he was a Renaissance man in many ways, and just an inspiration for me.
What a great man. So, and that led to, you know, as you were a child, doing your comic books. Now, what type of comic books did you write? Were they superhero based, or were they So did you make yourself a superhero then?
Well, the thing was that my brother and I think we were convinced that we were superheroes. We just hadn't figured out what our powers were. So instead we put ourselves into the stories. It was kind of like a ripoff of the Justice League of America, but Justice League of Armin and Ara, you know, that was really probably closer to it. And of course there was a Wonder Woman there. You always had to have a woman in the story. It wouldn't make sense otherwise. I gotta admit, you know, one of the things as a kid, reading the comic books, and you know, the basic story of the comic books usually are, that the hero is someone you would never expect. You know, they're and they don't do it for the fame, because you never know who it really is, except for Iron Man, of course. But it was never really about their fame. For me, when I would read these books, I always thought about what phenomenal characters that here they're doing it purely for altruistic reasons. And I always thought, well, it'd be great if I was a superhero one day. You know, it would be so nice if I could fly. That was my favorite. If I could fly, I would be great, but I'm still working on it.
Now, did you understand at that age that the superheroes did it, you know, really to help people, and, you know, they had these alter egos that were really not driven by, you know, the recognition and things like that? Or is that something that you realized later on as an adult? Because until you said that, to be quite frank with you, I don't ever know if I'd ever thought about it that way.
I must admit, I was, I think, 11 or 12. We had just moved to the States when it clicked in for me. And it was the stories of Spider-Man that did it for me. The original stories, the first 20 or so issues, when you read it, it's your classic young adult novel. Here is a kid who's truly the odd kid out. And I thought, you know, why don't you tell them? Why don't you tell them you're Spider-Man, you know? So that everyone will respect you. And he never did, because he needed to protect those around him, his aunt and so on. So I thought that's when it clicked in for me that, you know, he's not doing it to become famous. He's not doing it to be rich, because clearly if you want, you could do a lot of things to become rich. But so I saw it as, you know, this is pretty cool. That's what a hero is all about.
Wow. So you come to the States, you go and get your MBA from USC, who is actually, they're having a good football season this year after, you know, kind of a little rough start. So things are looking up for them. So along the way in your career as a technology executive, did you write fun things for the company that you worked for, or, you know, do other creative things? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is, how did you curtail your creativity as somebody who writes as well as you do for, you know, the time that you were in school until, you know, 5 years ago? Did you keep it bottled up, or what happened?
Great question. What happened was, in high school, I have to step back a little bit. In high school, my high school teacher, I don't think she ever gave me anything better than a C+. So no matter what I wrote, it seemed like I was typecast. And in my mind, I thought, all right, you know, I guess this whole dream of being like my grandfather is not going to happen. So I really wrote it off. Even though I would write essays and things like that, creative essays, I never thought it would be anything more than that. But when I went to college and I took my first creative writing class, and I got an A on the first one, something didn't seem right, because I'm not supposed to get A's. That was the class that I was supposed to get a C, maybe C+.
Right.
But then by the end of the semester, I've gotten an A in the class, and I received a letter asking me to join the honors program for writing. And I thought, okay, so this totally does not jive with what I thought my writing was about. But of course, I'm still in the mindset that I'm going to be an engineer, I'm going to be a responsible person, so I totally put it off. Fast forward to when I graduated, I started working for Hitachi at that point. It's kind of like it's a bug, it's a disease to a certain extent. I remember sitting, it was late at night, I was waiting for a conference call with my colleagues in Tokyo, and an idea for a story just came as I was sitting there. And because I was waiting, I just started writing. And before I know it, I'd finished about 4 pages of the story, and the conference call started, and I saved that file, and I thought, you know, I should look at this a little bit later. So what I did over time, I just looked at it once in a while, and I kept on going back to it, and it was bad, to be honest. It was bad, and I just threw it away, and I said, okay, you know, I got a career. I have to be responsible, and so on. So, again, I put it off until I started graduate school, which was – I was 30 when I started graduate school. At that point, a little cat showed up at our house, a little miracle cat that we saved. And he really, we call him a miracle cat because he really caused a transformation in our lives. So when that happened, I decided I'm going to write a story about this guy. And I started writing the story about these cats. It was called Tale of Two Kitties. And it was horrible also. I mean, so I kept on writing.
Was it horrible? Did you show it to anybody else who said, Ara, this is really horrible? Or you just read it and said, oh, my God, this is horrible?
Okay, so I don't know if my wife is listening, but this is what happened. I decided to show my wife the first chapter. So, okay, I just want to point out, I've written for about like 6-7 years on this horrible book because I'll be on and off again.
Right.
So I show my wife the first chapter. We're in the car driving, and my wife's a teacher. So she has this teacher look on her face, and she's reading it as I'm driving. I keep on almost swerving off the freeway. When she's done, she just kind of like literally tosses it on the floor next to her, and she says, I have no interest to read any more of this. And, of course,
wow.
At that point, I thought, okay, do I go off the freeway? Of course, she said it in a quasi-loving way because she knows that I can take it. But she said, you're better than this. You know, and she knew something about me before I did. And I said, okay, that's it. At that point, I realized I'm trying to do this on my own. I'm trying to figure out craft without actually putting the due diligence. And in anything in life, if you're going to do it, you better study it, learn it, because you can't break the rules unless you understand the rules. And you can't really become better until you actually understand what the baseline is. So that's what I did. I went and bought a handful of books, but the book that saved my writing, called Plot and Structure by James Scott Bell, that thing, as I read through it, everything it said don't do, I realized I was doing exactly that. I was the anti-book. You know, I could be a case study, you know, that says this is exactly what you shouldn't do. So, but that's what started me to think like a writer. And I started writing a couple of short stories, shared it with my wife and a close friend, and the feedback was fantastic. And I wrote another one. At that point, by the time I was done with my third short story, I knew that I understood the mechanics. Now I had to find the right story.
Well, we're going to talk about the right story with your book, Game of Love, after the break at the half hour. So we have a lot of writers that listen in on the show, especially when we have fantastic authors like yourself. So this is our chance to talk about you and what makes you tick and how you like to write, where you like to write. So I want to ask you about your writing process. You know, are you a pen and paper kind of a guy, or are you somebody that sits down at a typewriter or the computer? Where do you find your inspiration once you decide that you're going to be inspired for the day?
Great question. Yeah. In fact, I'm a little bit of everything except for the typewriter. I don't own the typewriter anymore. This is what my process is. I could be in the middle of anything, listening to an interview, listening to music, listening to a conference call. And when the idea comes, at that point, I'm pen and paper. And I carry these journals with me, and I start jotting down notes because this is where the seed of the idea is being born for me. So I start literally sketching, and I'm not writing in longhand, but it's just ideas that are coming at me really fast, and I don't want to lose any of it. So I start writing it out on a piece of paper. But immediately after that, I'm in front of my computer, and I use this application called Scrivener. At one point, I was teaching workshops on how to use Scrivener at the Southern California Writers Conference and also at the Santa Barbara Writers Conference, because to me, it became a game changer. It allowed me to be structured, but in a very creative way. It allowed me to write in scenes with scenes. I said to you earlier that I was a big comic book fan, and the reality is it carried over into my writing. I think in scenes. I think cinematically. I think the way I think a movie director thinks. So it allows me to write in scenes, and I start jotting out what are some of the key scenes and the key beats that I need to make sure the story has. So it starts on piece of paper, but it very quickly graduates into Scrivener, and I start building out the 20 to 40 scenes that will make the core of the story. And it's at a very high level. I don't go into paragraphs and paragraphs per scene. What I want to do is I want to capture the essence of what's happening here.
Okay, I'm making notes because I want to go get the Scrivener program. Is it an app, or is it like a, you know, like Word or Excel where you got to go buy a program like that? Where do people find this?
Yes, it is. It's a desktop application. It's available both for Windows machines and for the Mac. However, the Apple version is more advanced. The company, they're called Literature and Latte, small company out of the UK. I want to say the tool is either $40 or $50. And for those who are participating in NaNoWriMo that's going on right now, if you finish, you get a 50% off coupon from Literature and Latte. This thing, honestly, it could be worth a couple of $100 and it's still worth it. But if you go to literatureandlatte.com or just do a Google search on Scrivener, you will find that there's a lot of best-selling authors out there use this tool because it could be as simple or as complex as you want, and everyone has a different flavor of how much they want the tool to get in their way. I honestly don't work in Word anymore, other than when I'm done, I export it to Word so that I can send it to my literary agent, and then when I'm working with the editor at the publisher. Otherwise,
holy
it's
cow.
All done right there. Everything is there. In fact, I even push it out to my Kindle or to my iPad so that as I write, for example, tonight when I write, whatever I'm done with, I'm going to push it out so that it'll be on my Kindle the next morning. Sometime during lunch, I'll read the pages that I wrote so that my mind is back on where I was the night before, so that by the time I'm ready to write again, the ideas are flowing for the next scene and the scene after. It's a phenomenal tool. Highly recommend.
You are inspiring me tonight, and I'm sure the millions of people that are listening in tonight to go check this out. I think I've kind of heard of the program before, Ara, but I don't think anybody's really kind of told me. It's just kind of been, well, of course you have to know what this is, and it's just used in passing. So thanks for kind of giving the 411 on this. So now you're a published author, you're a fantastic writer. We're going to talk about the book Game of Love after the break. But when you got ready to sit down and write this book, what did you have any authors that were either mentors to you or authors that you really liked to read? And what was it about the people or their style of writing that really captured your attention?
Boy, yeah. that there's a lot there. Let's start with the mentors. When I first finished Game of Love, and of course my wife is always the first reader, if she doesn't approve, nobody else sees it. So there's a handful of dead books out there on my computer. but once my wife had read it, no man should ever admit this, but I made my wife cry, which for me that was a sign that I hit the right emotional notes with it. So once she was good with it, I knew that it just wasn't good enough for me to say, hey, my wife loves it. You know, it's the joke, right, that people contact their they're trying to get a literary agent, and they say, hey, you know, my wife loved it, my mom loved it, this is going to sell millions. So
right.
I didn't want to be one of those guys. So I did reach out to a gentleman. His name is I'll give you a little bit more information about him in a second. But what I did is I reached out to a professional reader. So I decided, okay, I'm gonna reach out to someone who's professional, get them to read it, and give me their feedback. He did, and he came back very quickly, and he was just over the moon with it. And he thought it was great. He had some feedback. In fact, he kind of made me change my entire Act 3 because he said my readers would want to kill me if I went to book. I went out that way. But what ended up happening is after I had given it to him, he decided that he was going to reach out to agents that he's worked with before. But the reality was the book, I knew it all along, the book really wasn't ready. So a little short bit after that, I said, you know, if I'm going to continue to make a commitment to writing, I need to go ahead and go to a good writer's conference and make the right contacts and start working from there. So I went to the Southern California Writers Conference. That was 4 years ago, I believe. That was my first conference ever. Met a handful of wonderful people. And one of the workshops that I took was with this freelance editor. Her name is Jean Jenkins. I took a workshop with her, and her feedback was so powerful that I said, you know, I need a partner, and she became my partner, and she continues to be my partner. When I'm comfortable with it goes to her as a professional editor. She goes through it, gives strong developmental feedback, and then I go to my beta readers, to my critique partners who will give me additional feedback. I believe in the craft is about work, and you got to put in the effort. And you got to surround yourself with the right people to make sure they give you the kind of feedback that helps you get better. And I'm very fortunate in that respect. So, yes, the mentors became Jean Jenkins. and Michael Levin, the gentleman who helped me, who was my initial mentor. But now I can easily argue that I have a lot of mentors, because all the people who are my critique partners, they help me as much as I help them, and that is the secret sauce, I would say, to producing a good product. You really need to be surrounded with the right people to do this properly.
So how did
and
you
I'm not
vet
sure
your
all your questions?
No, that's great. But how did you vet your team of people that you decided that, hey, these are going to be the people that have got my back and I've got theirs? I mean, did it you know meet over a cup of coffee and it just clicked, or did you have them fill out a questionnaire, or how did that work?
It was really mostly from the conferences. I met a handful of people from conferences, but then again, a couple of people, it was through a friend of a friend. You know, we started talking, we clicked, and we started building a friendship on Facebook and Twitter. And then, you know, you get the courage at one point and you ping them and you say, you know, I just finished with my draft. I would love to get your feedback if you don't mind. Now, of course, they have to be someone who reads and writes in your genre. Otherwise, you know, if I write, if somebody who's writing erotica gives it to me, I'm probably not going to be able to give you really good feedback, because I don't really understand what the expectations of the genre are. Readers have expectations, so I can probably give you feedback on craft, and I can tell you if, you know, if your pacing is good and stuff like that, but I can't tell you if it's too much or too little, or if the mystery is good enough, you know, and so on, or if the world building you're doing is appropriate for a fantasy reader. For someone like me, you probably need to do more world building for me to get it, but someone who's a fantasy reader will probably get a lot of the elements faster than I would. So you got to find people that are somewhat comfortable with your genre so they can give you feedback that's meaningful. But really, I always look for character. Even in my day job, when we're interviewing to hire, someone else will do the technical questions. I'm looking for fit of character. If the person appears to be their heart's in the right place, and what they want to do is help you become better, then to me that's already 90% of the battle. The rest of it is, you know, I've read their work, so I know if they're good writers themselves, so it's easy for me. They got the goods, they'll be able to help me also.
I love it. So let's talk about this, because, you know, a lot of, and you mentioned this at the beginning, you know, everybody in Hollywood, you know, oh, I'm an actor, oh, I'm a writer, oh, I'm a this, oh, I'm a that. But, you know, of course, everybody does something else during the day to pay the bills, myself included. So, you know, we're all part of that, you know, elusive thing. So when do you find time on a regular basis, or what is your writing schedule? Do you commit to writing 5 days a week at a certain hour? Where do you write? I know you talked about being in meetings in Tokyo, or, you know, you've got your notepads and things like that, but do you have a structured time that you set aside to sit down and write every day?
Yes. Now, I probably have to qualify it and say before publication and after publication, things changed a little bit. But up to the point where I was a month before Game of Love came out, I had a very, very structured schedule, and thanks to my wife, she gave me the space and the place to do it. You know, so basically, I would write every night, right around 9 o'clock or so, when our kids would go to sleep. I would sit behind the computer and write until my fingers hurt, or suddenly I would fall asleep and my head would hit the keyboard. So I would write in the first few years, first 3 years. So this is it's been the past 5 years that's been like this. For the first 3 years, I was writing until about from 9 o'clock till about 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my gosh.
I would write continually, and I would wake up right around 5:30 or 6 in the morning to, you know, try to help my wife with getting the kids ready for school and so on, and then the day starts. So for the first 3.5 years, that's how I did things. I slowed it down a little bit. I think age is catching up with me, maybe. But it moved from it basically became from 9 to midnight. That's my typical schedule. Now, what happened right around the time, about a month before Game of Love was going to come out, this thing called promotion kicked into a different gear. I got to tell you, the people who have they have publicists on staff, you know, they hire a publicist. All the power to them. You know, it's such a phenomenal thing to have. I wish I did, because it really takes up every waking hour to do this properly. It's beyond just sitting there and tweeting, but it's kind of being available to people. It's being ready for interviews, whether it's something for a blog post doing a review for a book, helping out other authors as they're doing publicity launches, because it really does take a community. It does take a family to do these things properly. And frankly, I'm a bit of a data geek, so when I do some targeted ads on Twitter or on Facebook, I want to see what's happening. You know, what works, what doesn't. Which images get people to click? Words happen to work better. So I'm looking for those things, because everything I learn is going to be applied to the next book and the book after and so on. For me, this is a marathon. It's not one book and done, but this is my first book. So I want to learn from it and apply it to everything else and hopefully build momentum from there.
Well, and I think this is a perfect time to take a little break. We're going to hear from our friends at It Matters Radio. I should hook you up with these folks, Ara. They interview authors as well. And after, you know what, I've got a whole list of people I can refer you to. But in the meantime, I got to, you know, promote this show. So It Matters Radio, and then a little bit of, you know, coffee to keep you percolated tonight from Rainbow Brew. We'll be right back in 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Stay tuned, everybody.
Welcome to our discussion of It Matters Radio. Our guest today is Angus McWilliams.
Hey, laddie, let's get on with this thing. I'm on my way to a birthday party for Nessie.
You're throwing a birthday party for the Loch Ness Monster?
Well, first of all, it's not a monster. And second of all, I'm talking about niece Nessie. She's a wee bit of a lovely lass.
I see. Well, okay. Angus, can you give us your thoughts on It Matters Radio?
Aye, wonderful people. They had me on a while back to talk about my book.
Your what?
My book. I wrote a book about the adventures in Scotland.
Oh, I see. A book.
That's what I just said. What are you, deaf man?
It Matters Radio focuses on discovering new talent and bringing important indie artists on the air. Monica, Kenneth, and Carrie offer up meaningful conversation on new music, books, and fun topics. It's unlike any other radio program known to man and woman alike.
You can say that again.
Known to man and woman alike.
Just because I said you can say it again doesn't mean you have to say it again.
I'm just doing my best to show everyone that It Matters Radio basically brings variety, fun, and entertainment with a sincere desire to discover new topics and talent.
Oh, why didn't you just say that?
I just did.
Hey, laddie, remind me when I can listen.
It Matters Radio is on every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
You Americans with your different time zones. We only have one time zone in Scotland.
And that would be?
That would be the time to down a pint or two of ale.
It Matters Radio, for the best in conversation, music, books, and entertainment. Join us Thursday evenings at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific. Discover the depth, diversity, meaningfulness, caring, guest-focused, friendly, enjoyable atmosphere of It Matters Radio with Ken, Monica, and Carrie.
That's a mouthful if I ever heard one.
Yes, and I'm going to go brush my teeth now. It Matters Radio.
When it comes to coffee, freshness is queen. That's why Rainbow Brew believes you should have the freshest coffee, roasted to order in small batches and delivered to your door within a couple days. Whether you're purchasing for a coffee shop, restaurant, or home, Rainbow Brew is your one-stop shop for fair trade and organic coffee. Offering many unique blends, including AM 950's own Blue State blend. That's Rainbow Brew, the Queen Bean, a proud sponsor of the Morning Grind. Online at rainbowbrew.com. Brew something good today.
Thanks to Rainbow Brew for being a proud sponsor of the show. I always tell people that I was floored when we got them on as a sponsor because they're, number one, out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and number two, they're a coffee company that brews coffee and grows their own beans out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. The frozen tundra of the world grows coffee beans, and they make delicious flavors. So if you go and order some, make sure to tell them you heard them here on the program so they can do a little happy dance, because they will do one for you. Tonight we have best-selling author Game of Love is the book by author Ara Gregorian. Ara, we've been talking about you, which I still want to talk more, but we need to talk about your book. So tell us about Game of Love, because I want to make sure at the end of this, people are as excited about it as I am, and they go to Amazon and buy the book or come to a book signing and buy the book. And with the holidays coming up, my advice is always buy 10. And the reason you buy 10, you keep one for yourself and you give 9 away as gifts, and then you have, you know, nice presents next year, because people will say, I got this really great book from Ara last year, and it was even autographed. So if you get a chance to do that, buy 10.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, well, you gotta move some merchandise here. So tell us about Game of Love. So this is your first published book. How did you know? I know that you have a fantastic editor in your wife, and I think that is great to have somebody who's disciplined enough to just say, you know, this is good or this is bad. But how did you come up with a story for this? Because when you told me, you said, you know, I've got this book, and Jeff said, it's a romance novel. I just went, okay, and I can't put this book down. This is on it, and I'm not trying to say this because you're my guest. I'm saying it because it's genuinely a fantastic book. This is a very hard book to put down because, in like any good book, you know, the characters are interesting, they're relatable, and you just want to see what happens next. So, okay, I'm going to stop now because I'm just going to keep gushing. Tell us about the book.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You know, I got to tell you, any author who tells you differently, they're lying. When a reader says, I couldn't put your book down, that's probably the most wonderful compliment anyone can give. You know, authors spend so much time. You know, we slave over the smallest little difference between one word or the other, and we sometimes are not even sure if anybody's going to look at that kind of feedback. It's just fantastic. So really, I appreciate that. So Game of Love, I got to admit, you know, I told you earlier that, you know, I was writing these short stories and, you know, I was now ready to write a novel. I was sure I was going to be like either a mystery writer or a writer. I was going to write thrillers because that's the kind of stuff I was reading. And so here I am on a business trip in Paris. It was in May. It happened to be during the French Open, which is one of the four Grand Slams in tennis. And at the hotel that I was staying in, there, a lot of the athletes were staying in, and I'm a tennis fan, so I recognized them. And there was a particular athlete. She entered the elevator at the same time as I did, and I wished her luck. And I thought, how cool is that? You know, I got to meet a tennis star. So we go upstairs to where the restaurant is for breakfast, and she's sitting there having her breakfast, and I notice this young guy's looking at her. And he's looking at her kind of like with these loving eyes, maybe a little freaky, but in any event, he's looking at her. And, and at that point, I thought, you know, I wonder how these people can make a relationship work. And I started thinking about the real big names, the Maria Sharapovas of the world, and Anna Kournikova, who's famous for, you know, kind of getting beaten down for not winning it all, not winning a Grand Slam. And I thought, boy, can these people actually have a normal relationship? So that started going through my mind, and then every other famous person you can think of went through my mind. You know, you look around, and celebrities in general, their relationships don't last, and it's usually plastered all over the place. So the idea of here you have a famous tennis player, an athlete, a superstar in their own right, trying to find love became interesting to me. So at that point, the idea started just percolating in my head. And by the time I was on the flight back, I was on the airplane and I started writing the breakfast scene that you read already from chapter one. The idea just started at that point, and I realized as the flight, I think we were over New York at this point, and I thought, wait a minute, am I writing a love story? I'm not supposed to be a romance writer. I'm supposed to write mysteries and suspense. But there it was. You know, I was writing a story about two characters that I cared deeply about. I wanted to know what's going to happen to them. And I really didn't know if they would be able to work it out. But I was committed to finding out because, to me, these characters were interesting enough that I had to find out.
So as you come to this, you know, this light bulb goes off in your head and you say, I'm going to explore this. Did you know where you were going to cross the finish line before you started, or was it an organic process that just kind of developed along the way?
Definitely organic. I always have an idea. In general, I have an idea of where I think it's going to go. But I definitely allow my characters to take over. I honor what they do. And it'll happen often. And it probably I don't know if it's magic, to be perfectly honest with you, probably some level of subconscious. But, you know, I will be in the middle of a scene and one of them says something that I was not planning for them to say. And I pause there and I think, that's not what was supposed to be written. But holy crap, that'll definitely work. Let's go with it.
And one person told me, honor your characters and your characters will do good for you, you know, and it has worked out for me, to be honest. It's very organic. The end always changes because sometimes I'm not even really sure what the theme is until I'm done. And that's when it all comes together for me and I realize, so that's the story I'm telling. So I go back and I start fixing it to adjust for what I really realize the story's about.
So how often did you find yourself surprised at what you wrote? Or, you know, as you know, you say, oh, I didn't know the character was going to say that. How often did that play into your writing?
With Game of Love, probably a good half a dozen times it happened. With my second book, probably 24 times. That book has put me through the ringer, but for good reasons, because the story continues to evolve. But with Game of Love, a good half a dozen times, things would happen, and I would just step back and say, okay, what am I doing here? So at least a good half a dozen times.
So tell us, can we, giving like character names here, tell us a little bit about what actually happens in the book. So you told us how you got the idea for the book, but what starts to happen in the book for the characters, and tell us a little bit about them and why people are going to fall in love with them as easily as they will.
I wish I was a better marketer, but I'll do my best to try to explain the story. This is a story of redemption at its core. We all probably have read or know someone who has fallen from grace. And this is the story of Gemma Lennon, a 21-year-old British tennis star. And she was the kind of person that at 15, everyone said she would be the next great thing. But she became a celebrity more than an athlete. So now here we are 6 years later when she has become a professional athlete. And she wants to prove to the world that she can be, or she can live up to the hype that was built around her. So this is her story. And as the story begins, we see how the celebrity life, the impact of the paparazzi, and how her personal life continues to be splattered all over the place, gets in the way of her goal to win a Grand Slam. And for those who don't know tennis, you really don't need to know tennis, because you will get what the story is about. And if you know tennis, you will be content, because I stay true to the sport. But you know, for most athletes, what they're trying to do in tennis is they're trying to win a Grand Slam, because that really defines their career. It means that they were the best in the world at that point, and they are part of a select few. So many athletes never get a chance to even compete at that level, much less win it. So Gemma's story is that that's what she's trying to do, but she bumps into this American businessman, Andre Reyes, who is an outlier in his own right. I mean, he is a brilliant, gifted man, a wonderkind. And what happens is that she sees in him what she is, and they are kindred spirits in many ways. And he helps her see that the game of life is bigger than just winning and competition and money and so on. That the game of life really is won when you find the right person. But of course, you know, to anyone who's a professional, that concept of work-life balance, what do you give up? You know, do you really give up for a professional athlete? In this case, in Gemma's case, 15, 16 years of her life has been all about tennis. Does she give that up just because she fell in love, because she doesn't want her personal life to be splattered all over the place? Or do you give up that once-in-a-lifetime relationship? Life is all about choices, and this story puts Gemma in a position where she has to choose powerfully.
And, well, can we talk about her male companion here in the novel a little bit as well, because I find him as fascinating as Gemma. And I thought that was something that I was not going to appreciate when I kind of figured out who it was going to be. Because, you know, in the beginning, you know, there were in the first couple of paragraphs about, you know, who she's meeting and that type of stuff, I was thinking, okay, her love interest is going to be this person. Nope, it wasn't going to be that person. And then it's finally the person that it is. Can you tell us a little bit, you know, what drives him as well? Because you've described Gemma brilliantly, but you have this, this super stud that just kind of comes out of nowhere and just sweeps her off of her feet. And I think it catches both of them off guard.
Yeah, no, great question. You know, so to everyone that's listening, the story originally I thought was Andre's story. I thought Andre Reyes was the main protagonist, and this was going to be his story. And I realized after I was done with the first draft that no, it's really Gemma's story that Andre is the agent of change. And so Andre, first of all, is a composite of a few people that I met throughout my life. You know, brilliant people. There's this concept out there that's called polymath. So for those of you who are interested, search on that, and you'll see that people like Leonardo da Vinci were considered like one of the first recorded polymaths. These are people who are just truly gifted in so many diverse areas, from technology, art, communications, philosophy, etc. So really scary people. In fact, my alma mater, USC, has a program, the Academy for Polymathic, that identifies people like this. So he is not one of those far-fetched type of people, but he is one of those brilliant people. But again, his story was very similar, that here is a guy who at a very young age realizes he's different than anyone else in his school. He starts going to college at the age of 11, gets multiple degrees, goes on to get a couple of PhDs when he is 14, works for the NSA as a teenager. In fact, I know a couple of people who did this kind of a life. So for me, these people were phenomenally fascinating because they are dangerous if they have the wrong moral compass. But if they come from the right seed, you know, they could become phenomenal in helping solve world problems. So Andre is one of those guys, but at a very young age, he saw money. He saw consulting as the opportunity to make a lot of money, and he went after it. And he is now 23, 24 in the book, making a lot of money, but he is also burning out. He is at the point where after all these years of doing that and earning a very handsome living, he has decided that that's it. I can't do this much longer. And he just wants his contract to run out so that he could just live a different life. So when he meets Gemma, it's at that perfect moment that he gets it. She doesn't yet.
Well, and I think what I really liked about the whole dynamic with everything that is going on is that Andre, he's at, 23, 24, like you said, and he is counting the clock. And in everything that he's doing, at least up to the point where I'm reading in the book, you know, he's like, I've got to make sure that, I don't have them look at me a certain way, or they can't find out I actually have a personal life, and I can't do this, and I can't do that. And it causes him a lot of health issues. You know, and I thought, on the flip side, for Gemma, all she's ever doing is thinking about how she's breathing or how she's looking or how she's doing whatever. I meant to ask you this specifically about Gemma. Why is she so fixated on her breathing all the time? Because I find her concentrating on that type of thing, at least in the first half of the book, to the point where it's like she's a little obsessive about it. And I thought there has to be some kind of like reasoning behind that.
There is. You know, I did a lot of research on athletes, professional athletes specifically. You know, and one thing that I found over and over again was that they have they kind of have conversations, very prolonged conversations in their own head, and breathing becomes a technique that they use to shut out the noise in their world. It's like this hyper focus that they go into because, you know, they can't pay attention to anything else that's going on. And if for anyone who's studied meditation, the breathing process, you know, of the air that goes in, how it enters your lungs, you literally visualize air particles, filling your lungs and so on. I found it fascinating as I was doing this research that one athlete after another, they continue to focus on this concept of breathing to find their center. So that's why you see that initially a lot of it, because it's a little bit about how she finds her safe place. Because, you know, if you think about most athletes or famous people, they really are awkward in the real world. They have a hard time relating with the average person because they're not used to that world anymore. They're used to people who are continuously giving them platitudes and telling them how great they are and how wonderful they are. But when they're in the outside world, they got to find a way to try to just, you know, pull away and be safe.
Well, and I think that the – and I'm not giving anything away because this is really early in the book. But one of the things that, you know, ultimately happens when Andre and Gemma meet is that, you know, they end up in like Santa Monica or Malibu or something like that. And she goes and gets to kind of hang out with him and his family and their friends. And she's really kind of freaked out about the fact that, yeah, they all kind of know who she is. But they're just like, come on, we're hanging out. And it's like – they're not taking my picture. They're not selling my story. They're not doing anything else. And I was really intrigued on how you brought that all together and made it just seemed. I mean, every word you write, Ara, I could see on a movie screen. Your book needs to be a movie, so and maybe even a trilogy. I don't know. We'll turn it. You know, we've got to get a good deal for you. But everything that you wrote, I could see on the screen, and I could just see it playing out so flawlessly. There's not a word yet that I've read that I would say, why did he do this or why did he do that? It just all makes sense, and I think it speaks of great, great writing. We've got probably about 7 minutes left, and I want to make sure everybody knows Ara's book, Game of Love, is available on Amazon. If you want to go to the Rated G Radio Superstar Swag page on Amazon, I've got a link at the bottom there. Or just go to your regular Amazon page. It's all through Amazon. Buy his book. Are you doing book festivals, book signings, world tours, or anything like that coming up that we need to let people know about?
Not world tours, but close. In 2 weeks, I'm going to be in Orange County. And if anyone wants to go on my website, they'll be able to find this. There's an organization called Lit Up. And I'm going to be there with, I believe, two other authors where I'll be reading some pages from my book. There's an opportunity to do some book signing there. But if you go to my website, rrgregorian.com or tennisnovel.com, you will find that in the events section. I'll be doing that. There's a couple of other things that are coming up that we're working on, but one other thing that I'm really excited about is that in February, again with the Southern California Writers Conference, I've been teaching some workshops there, but in February in San Diego, I'll be teaching basically a five-part workshop where I'll be helping writers take the concept, starting from the concept, through building out their core story beats, to building out the character and the motivations of the character, and get to a point that by the time you're done, you're in a position where you know your story, your character, the motivations, where you want to take it, and you'll be able to just start writing this thing. So I'm really excited about that, and there'll be an opportunity for me to do some book signings there as well. Finally, if all goes well, in March, there's a big tennis tournament called in Indian Wells. My publisher is working to try to get me to do a book signing there. 50,000 or so tennis fans will be there, so I'm really looking forward to that. I hope we can pull it off. It'd be a mini coup to stand in the hands of tennis lovers because I really believe that they will find a lot to love about the book there.
Well, just like with tennis, you need two players, so they're going to have to buy two copies of the book, one for them and one for a friend, so you need to take 100,000 copies with you. So
sounds like a plan.
I'm so excited. I want to take your workshop now, so we'll have to talk about that because that's something that interests me a great deal. Can we go back real quick in talking a little bit about the marketing and, you know, publicity and things like that for your book? You know, when you're doing this yourself, what has been something that you know, here's the two sides of the coin, that you found really easy to do but then also really struggled to do?
Wow. Okay, so first I need to make sure that I give credit to my publisher as well, because although they're a small press, an independent press, they've done a lot to try to get my name out there. But the reality is there's a lot of noise out there, and being heard is very difficult. The reality is, Garrett, I'm gonna be very honest with you. I don't think there's anything easy in the publicity side of this business. Nothing has come easy for me, and talking to others, whether they're traditionally published or self-published, they'll probably tell you the same thing, that for the most part, it takes a lot of work, and what worked this week may not necessarily work the next week. But I'll tell you this, for me, probably the easiest thing is just being me and putting myself out like that in social media, trying to be interesting by just using my natural humor. My wife sometimes says it's nauseating, my humor, but I hope that it, sometimes it's funny. But in a good way. She means it in a good way, because I like to hear myself speak, as your audience has probably picked up on that. But, you know, just being myself, that's been the easiest, although I know it's not easy for a lot of writers. What's been the hardest is trying to be noticed among the crowd of writers out there. There really is so many people out there, and especially in romance, which kind of makes up half of all books that are being sold, here you are trying to stand out. You're really trying your best to stand out, but every day thousands of romance books are coming out, and you're going up against that. So what I had to count on was to write a great book, make sure that it's clean, got lucky with a really nice book cover, and then, you know, hope for the best. You know, luck is the rest of the equation, and I got very lucky that an international organization, Reader's Favorite, they awarded my book the gold for sports fiction for the 2015 International Book Award. I was stoked when I got that award in September. That kind of a thing becomes a differentiator: awards, recognition, reviews. I am also surprised that I've gotten as many reviews as I did, because I know it's so hard to get reviews. So to those who've read it and haven't reviewed, I would really appreciate if you want to say, throw a word, even if it's critical, it's fine. Readers will appreciate seeing critical reviews as well. But those things help authors a lot.
So as we get ready to wrap up, you've got another book. And I should know this, and I apologize, I don't. Is your second book out?
No, it is not out yet. In fact, it is with my agent, my super agent, the wonderful Stacey Donaghy. Please do not query her. I can't have her be more busy than she is. So my agent has my manuscript, but in the full disclosure, she received an earlier version about 4 or 5 months ago, and she browbeat me on things that she loved and things that she felt I needed to fix. And at first I was offended, because I am Aura. How can you tell me I'm wrong? But
right.
Then I realized that she was absolutely right. And the version that I've done, I am so much happier with it. So it's with her. Hopefully in the next few weeks, we'll be in a position to start looking to getting it out there into the publishing world again.
Can you give us a clue on what that one's going to entail?
Sure. The working title, it's probably going to change, it's called 10 Years Later. A story based around the 10-year high school reunion. The story of two best friends, Pete and Sophie, who have been best friends since sixth grade. They have a lot of skeletons in their closet, and the reunion is an opportunity for them to try to put right to those things that went wrong in those days. So I'm not going to say much more than that.
No,
but
don't do that. That's
like
fine.
Everything I write, it's a story of second chances.
Love it. So how do people find you on social media? How would you like people to stalk you and become fans and stay in touch?
Yeah, I'm probably the easiest person to find, because I'm always out there. But you can start with my website, auragregorian.com, or tennisnovel.com will take you there. I'm on Twitter, at Aura the Writer, A-R-A, the Writer. So anywhere that if you start there, you will find everywhere else that you can find me. Start from there and you'll find me. I'm hard to not discover out there.
And my last question for you is, because, you know, you're working, you've got the family, you've got your writing. What else are you passionate about in life?
Oh, boy. You know, I would say there's a couple of things that I'm passionate about, my kids and my wife. And the fact that we can spend time together when we do is wonderful. It's one of those things that it's really hard to come by, but I will admit that I was one of those guys who had taken my eye off of that. But recently, you know, we've discovered that that's really what matters. So we get to spend time together. We go to church together. We're able to, do more things together. So it's honestly, I wouldn't change anything in my life right now. I'm able to do what I love. I'm able to work at a job that respects me, and I'm able to have a family that's just beautiful. So I got it all good.
You are an amazing man. I'm so glad we had a chance to meet. I'm thrilled that you came on the show to promote Game of Love. Everybody go out and buy 10 copies. keep one for yourself. Nine is gifts. Christmas and the holidays are coming up. And that's it. We're out of time. Tomorrow night on Wednesday's show, we're going to have two guests. Walter Newkirk talks about his Grey Garden books, and then we're going to have indie filmmaker Jill Salvino talk about her new indie film as well. And the week will just fly by. Game of Love. Go buy it tonight. Everybody, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. We will see you live tomorrow. Don't drive distracted. And thank you, everybody, for making this show possible. Have a great night.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.